Welcome back to the podcast. Again, my name is Heath Brown, and today we are talking to the author of Delivering the People's Message, The Changing Politics of the Presidential Mandate, published by Cornell University Press this year. The author is Julia Azari. Julia, how are you doing today?
Great. How are you?
I'm doing great and enjoyed the book. Before we get to it, maybe you could just tell us a little bit about your background, where you are now, anything you'd like to share about who you are.
Sure. I'm an assistant professor at Marquette University in Milwaukee. I have a PhD from Yale, and I did my undergrad at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Let me talk just briefly about how I ended up studying presidential rhetoric. Can I do that for a second?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's a great way to jump in. Then we'll talk more about the specifics of the book.
Yeah, so I actually started my political science career as a comparativist, and I was really interested in transitions from authoritarian regimes. And as I read more about authoritarian regimes, I got really interested in the politics of justification and how these non-democratic regimes in various parts of the world would justify what they were doing. And so that is actually how I ended up studying presidential rhetoric. So I often tell people, you know, I started this to really get into comparative politics and political transitions in the world, and then I ended up studying American presidential speeches. But that theme of justification is kind of what ties it together.
Yeah, and I think that's such an interesting sort of way to start this conversation because, this is like a lot of the books that we write is focused on a small thing, but you wrap it up in this larger conversation.
Yeah, certainly that's what I tried to do, and I would hope that this would be of some interest to people in comparative politics and in political theory, and to kind of really think about what the presidential mandate means. Since wrapping up this project, I've kind of gone in other American politics directions with parties and ideologies and vice presidential selections. So that's kind of where I'm at now in my career, is I'm really interested in this president-party relationship and in institutional change across multiple institutional contexts.
Yeah, that's great. It's an interest of mine and something that I've written about as well. So let's start with the book. And let's say that a president has just won election.
Mm-hmm.
What are the range of things that he or she might say to support their agenda for their first 100 days? The mandate being one thing, but before we get to the sort of what the book is about, what are some of the other things, other justifications that at least in theory are out there?
Right. That's a great question. That is the question of this book, is kind of what are the alternatives? And this is lurking in the background of the text. But what I found reading all of these speeches over the course of the 20th century and the beginning of the 21st century is you get a couple different directions. One is rooted in kind of these broader philosophical concepts. And LBJ was big on this. He was big on talking about justice, talking about the values of America, talking about equality, and kind of using these more philosophical terms. Another way is to really talk about immediate problem solving. FDR was big on this. Eisenhower was big on this. Is much more pragmatic, and you can see why in both cases. Much more pragmatic. This is the problem that we're facing. This is what we're going to do to address it. George Herbert Walker Bush also was kind of like that, a more kind of pragmatic discourse. So those are the main ones that I find. Sometimes you get a more constitutional justification. Depending on the issue, you might get someone talking more about, you know, we need to do these things to get more in line with the text with our founding document or our founding values. That usually goes right into that philosophical language as well.
Yeah, but in addition to those, the one that people often pay attention to is the subject of your book, mm-hmm. which is these references to a mandate, which you know, in some ways has we could commonly understand in very crude ways, but you really pay attention to it. So what does it exactly mean for a president to refer to a mandate? How does that work?
So broadly, I define this as any time the president uses the election or the campaign to justify what they're doing. And in this book, and to some extent, and there's another article I published where I pay a lot more attention to these kind of categories of mandate, they can either talk about the magnitude of the election. So one way to talk about a mandate, and this is usually the way that I think creeps into journalistic language after an election has just occurred, is kind of, you know, what would be an exceptional enough result to constitute a mandate? So they talk about, sometimes in the journalistic conversation and other literature, they'll talk about, well, it was a surprise, or it was a majority, or it was a big majority, which gets very fuzzy very fast. Like, what kind of numbers justify an exceptional election result? So that's one definition. Another definition, which reaches further back into American history, and a lot of people attribute to Andrew Jackson, has to do with this idea that the president has a unique relationship with the people, and that members of Congress represent their districts or their states, what have you, but only the president is elected by the whole people, and so by virtue of that, the president is kind of this unique representative of the whole people. And Woodrow Wilson also had some writing on that topic and some ideas on that topic as well. And then finally, the one that I find is most common in the 20th century, and especially in the early 21st century, is this more almost European concept of a responsible party mandate. I said I would do this, I campaigned on it, people voted for me, and now I'm going to do it. And so that gets you out of some of these other problems. You don't have to make a unique claim as the president. You don't have to make a unique claim about the magnitude of the election victory. You can just say, I promised that I would do this, and I'm keeping my promise. And that has a lot of resonance when we think about how democracy is supposed to work. It really relates to ideas like transparency, accountability, keeping your promises, having distinct alternatives that people can choose from in the course of an election. A lot of really resonant concepts. So those are kind of the three main thrusts of mandate claiming that I find in both in the literature and also in the way that politicians and journalists talk about mandates.
Yeah, you've already alluded to sort of how far back you've gone, but let's talk about this just a little bit more specifically. What is the historical period that you cover, and what are the types of presidential rhetoric that you're focused on?
All right, so this is where things get interesting. The data set that I created, I created most of that while I was a grad student, and then updated it and expanded a little bit during my time here at Marquette, starts in 1929 and goes up through 2009. And what I look at is the first 70 days of each presidential term. In the broader scope of the analysis, I try to look a little bit further back, and I do look at inaugurals prior to that period to get a sense of mandate rhetoric in that context. But presidential speech data isn't as systematically collected prior to 1929. So the data set just goes that far back, and then I kind of fill in the context from the Progressive Era and a little bit from the 19th century. And I look at a really wide range of communications, or at least I tried to. So I include major addresses like the inaugural, like the first State of the Union, or, you know, joint session address in a presidential term, any televised addresses. I look at the radio addresses that Ronald Reagan kind of began in the early 80s and other presidents have kept up. I look at press conferences. I look at communications with the executive branch, communications with Congress, speeches to any kind of assembled group. So we might have the National Association of Governors or governors or mayors from a particular party. We might have, you know, the Boy Scouts or something like that. So a whole bunch of different organizations. So I looked at what I felt like was a pretty wide range of different types of presidential communications, not just major addresses.
Now, you also allude to kind of the conventional or the textbook or the popular explanation of mandates that would seem to permit only those with a large, whatever large is, large margin of victory to claim a mandate. But you suggest in 2001, just one example, that George W. Bush showed how this isn't always the case. So was President Bush acting out of turn, Or is this conventional hypothesis about electoral victory margin just largely wrong?
Yeah, so I think that there may be a little bit from column A and a little bit from column B there. I think to the extent that Bush used mandate language in 2001, it was maybe not completely disingenuous, right? And this is why, actually, the way that Bush used the mandate claims, I think, kind of illustrates the problem with this concept. So Bush obviously didn't win. He didn't win the popular vote at all. It was very, 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 very thin margin in 2000, as we all probably remember. So it wasn't anything like, you know, Ronald Reagan in 1984 or Lyndon Johnson in 1964. He couldn't claim to have this major big majority behind him, and he didn't claim that. When he was talking about his tax cuts, he said, look, I made it very clear what I stood for. He did say at one point, you know, Dick Cheney and I, you know, made it clear where we stood, and we wouldn't be here if we hadn't. But, you know, he never made any false claims about the magnitude of that victory. What he claimed was that they had taken a distinct position and that people had voted for them on the basis of that position. It's hard to attribute an aggregate feeling, right? You have millions of people, and so you can't really aggregate those preferences in any kind of meaningful way. And public choice theorists have really engaged with that, and William Riker has some writings from the early 80s about that. But, you know, reaching beyond that problem, if you're going to look at why people vote or why people aligned themselves with the Republican Party and then subsequently voted for Bush, you could do worse than tax policy. And in that sense, I thought some of his 2001 claims were probably some of the more resonant ones, even if that wasn't a huge part of the 2000 campaign necessarily. It seems like a kind of reasonable way to think about politics. I forgot how you phrased your second question, but so.
Well, and let me actually next, just.
I'm sorry.
No, and let me just ask for just a little clarification.
Yeah.
So in the area of tax, what would it sound like, or what did it sound like, for George Bush to make a claim about a mandate? How did he connect his electoral victory to the mandate he purported to have gotten for specific tax policies or a specific tax agenda?
Mm-hmm. Let me find it. There's a really great quote, and of course I have no idea where it is in my book because I haven't opened my book since I published it. And I'm not sure that I will be able to very quickly. Bush did a lot more of this in 2004. Are you asking what the claims looked like?
What did he say? If not literally, what did he say? What was the type of thing that he was saying? Given that he had other alternatives, he could have supported his tax claim based on his own ideological belief about the right tax policy. But the suggestion is that at least in part he based this on some sort of claim about his mandate.
Right. So something that Bush said both times, he said a lot more in 2005, but he did say it several times in 2001, is something along the lines of I made my position very clear. Everyone knew where I stood. They voted for me because of it, and now that's what I'm going to do. He also said this in the context, sorry, this is kind of coming back to me, and I go into this in more depth in a chapter in another book that I edited, and I have a chapter on mandates, but it's there's not as much of it in delivering the people's message about Bush's first term. But another thing he said, someone had asked him in an exchange with reporters. A reporter said, you know, why aren't you being more bipartisan on education? And he kind of said, well, I am being bipartisan, but also I took this position and everyone knew what I stood for. And so he uses it in that context as kind of a defense. So it's very much this responsible party notion that I made it very – it's very Bush, right? I made my position mm-hmm. clear. It's clear. Everyone knew and – now that's what I'm going to do. And there's this sort of implicit idea. So that sounds great in some ways, right? Everyone knows where everyone stands. But then there's this implicit idea that, well, And given that I won the election, the other side isn't really going to be participating in this anymore, which obviously is not how our system works and is particularly opens up a can of worms when you've only won the presidency because of a very narrow popular vote and then a split electoral college decision and everything that happened in 2000.
Right. So you do a lot of statistical analysis in the book, and without wading too deeply into the methods or statistics, you do develop a bit of a model to explain the prevalence or use of this kind of mandate language. So briefly, what is it? What are the factors that seem to relate to the use by presidents?
Right. So what I use, I actually just do some really straightforward correlations in the book. I use popular vote, the five factors that are in this table, in the data chapter in the book. I look at three different ways you could measure the election result. First of all, popular vote share, so how the percentage of the popular vote, the popular vote margin, so the margin of victory in the popular vote, and then the share of the electoral college. And those correlations are all basically non-existent. So then I look at public approval for the presidents where we have reliable data. And I just did an average of their public approval over the period where I have the rhetorical data, so from the inauguration through the end of March. And the correlation there is -0.45. And I look at polarization, which I use the DW nominate scores for the House to measure polarization. I did that using different Congresses. I used the one that met after the president took office. I used the one that had just concluded. I averaged the two, and the result was always about the same, if that makes any sense. That's probably methodological woods. Anyway, I did a bunch of ways to make sure the result wasn't a red herring. And polarization is correlated 0.53, which is statistically significant, I believe, for that N of 25 or whatever it is. So that's that's a pretty big correlation in a fairly small data set, and it's not a regression, so it's not controlling for anything. There's a lot of noise, and through all that noise breaks through this connection, right? These things both change over time. So there's this temporal dynamic, and the available data makes it really difficult to figure out what's doing the causing, which is why I did so much more qualitative analysis for the rest of the book. But the basic idea is that the two factors that seem to be consistently related to the use of mandate rhetoric are party polarization and declines in overall levels of presidential approval. So presidents don't claim mandates when they win big. They claim mandates when they're unpopular and when the parties are polarized.
And what does this mean? Help us make sense of this. As you just mentioned, you approached through much of the second half of the book the subject in a qualitative manner. But connect this to us to other things that we care about. I was particularly intrigued. Towards the end of the book, you describe a group called Use Your Mandate, mm-hmm. which sounds like a relatively recently formed group that maybe you can talk about. What role does the public have in pushing a president mm-hmm. to base policy on a mandate? Because there is this sort of push and pull. How does this relate to us in the electorate? Does it matter?
Yeah, so what I found looking in kind of a more stylistic way, the different policies that presidents had linked up to mandate claiming was actually those policies tend to lose. Those policies tend not to do well in Congress. Sometimes they're popular, but often they're not. One example of that is Bush's, in 2005, his push for privatizing Social Security, which was not a main issue in the election, was not especially popular, could not win over his own party, and yet he consistently used that language and claimed, similar to his language in 2001, that he had run on that. We see all sorts of different things. One thing that I talk about a little bit toward the end of the book is that there's a definite party trend that takes hold in the later part of the book. So starting with around Jimmy Carter, forward, which is that Republican presidents tend to really stay on message and they kind of stick to these bigger ideas. So with Bush, it's privatizing Social Security. In 2005, almost 30% of his speeches have some kind of mandate rhetoric, but they're all pretty much on Social Security. He doesn't mess around. Ronald Reagan sticks very much to the lower taxes, lower government spending. We're going to tame the inflationary monster is one thing he links to the 1980 mandate, which I thought was a fantastic turn of phrase. Whereas the Democrats are all over the place. The Democrats are, and it's always these small things that they link up with the election. So in Clinton, I'm actually looking at a table in the book right now. So Clinton claims a mandate for shrinking the White House staff, for technology policy, for the economic stimulus bill, for the White House Office on Environmental Policy, and for health care reform. Obama, in his first term, I haven't analyzed the data yet for the second term, so I'm not sure what went on in 2013, but in 2009, he has like 10 different items here. He talks about TARP, he talks about national service, he talks about stem cell research, biofuels, removing troops from Iraq, which seems plausible, but some of these smaller ones don't. I think Jimmy Carter was probably the worst offender here. In 1977, he talked quite a lot about doing what he was elected to do and the reasons he was elected. He was a big mandate claimer, although he didn't use that word. One thing he said was that he thought zero-based budgeting was the reason that he was elected, which I feel like just can't be true.
Right.
Right. These things that no one, if you polled people on the street, is going to have any idea what they even mean. Along with larger policies, and so Democrats have a tendency to dilute this message and Republicans stay on message. Can I talk a little bit about the historical trajectory here? Because you had asked earlier about, okay, what is going on here and why do those factors seem to be linked up with the mandate? And I can give you a little bit, kind of tie some of these different bits together a little bit if you'd like.
That would be great.
So this actually goes back to Jackson. What I find is that if I look at what other people have written, if we look to history, the situation is that presidents have long pushed at the boundaries of what seems like acceptable power. The Constitution is very vague about what presidents can and cannot do. They share their powers with Congress. So there's this kind of constant interbranch struggle and this constant struggle for legitimacy. And going back to Jackson, we see a reference to the mandate in the context of the war over the Second Bank of the United States, where Jackson, over the course of his presidency, did a whole lot of things that were out of step with accepted norms. He vetoed legislation just because he didn't like it. And he vetoed the bank. That was one of the things that he had vetoed the renewal of its charter, and then decided he wanted to kill it even faster. So he ordered his Secretary of the Treasury to remove deposits from that bank and place them in state banks before the charter had expired. So Jackson really interpreted presidential power in a pretty strong way. And he used the idea of the electoral mandate to justify that. And so we can take this as a Jackson story and just say, oh, well, Andrew Jackson, you know, he was just someone who was kind of a hothead. He had this idea about power. He was a general. But actually, I think this is not a unique Jackson story. This is a recurring issue over the course of the presidency. Presidents push at the boundaries of their power. And at the times when presidents are doing that in a way that's really public, to bring the electorate in, as you mentioned, in a way that everyone can kind of see, and in a way that really arouses their enemies, that's when we see them lean on mandate rhetoric. And the two instances that I talk about in the book where we see that are actually three kind of issues of different scope where we see this pattern recur. One is during the course of the Progressive Era, where people are really rethinking the presidency in a very broad way. Woodrow Wilson, in particular, was a proponent of this idea that the presidency could be a lot more powerful, a much bigger player, more parliamentary. The president could be a bigger kind of leader in Congress. And he linked up this idea of the president being responsive to the people as a way to justify that expansion of presidential power. We also see this during the court packing wars with FDR. When FDR was trying to change the structure of the Supreme Court in 1937, he's kind of under fire, the New Deal, different parts of it keep getting struck down by the Supreme Court. And then he comes out with his court packing plan, which then immediately becomes very controversial. He defends it in the course of a fireside chat in terms of a mandate, which is one of the really the only times that FDR comes forward with a strong mandate claim. We see it a few other times, but it's not a big topic in 1932. It's not a big topic in his later terms. It's really when he's like under fire and in this conflict about the boundaries of the office. And then in a more nefarious example, we also see that with Watergate and during Nixon's time in office, also a fight with Congress over the budget and over whether presidents can impound or refuse to spend funds that Congress has allocated. Nixon trots out the mandate to defend himself. The larger argument with regard to what's happened since the Carter administration, and particularly since, you know, with Obama and Bush, who were both big mandate claimers, the larger argument is that now presidents are kind of always in a boundary conflict, and that presidential legitimacy took a major hit after Vietnam and Watergate, from which has never really recovered, and that the polarization, which kind of started up around that same time and has since only gotten worse, has contributed to this. And so since presidents are constantly defending themselves and constantly under fire about the legitimacy of what they're doing, they've come to rely more on mandate rhetoric. And in that sense, the way that the electorate plays into this, I think, is potentially really problematic. It's problematic in the obvious way, which is that presidents are claiming mandates for things that were not necessarily the public's priorities. I think that does happen, because I think mandate rhetoric happens in response to the political challenges of the moment and is often very disconnected from whatever was being discussed during the election. But the more subtle problem there is that this is a kind of rhetorical buck passing. When presidents talk about more philosophical ideas or about problem solving, they're exercising leadership, taking the public's priorities and then kind of guiding the public, given that this is their full-time job, they're called to public service, they're elected, they have access to all this information, all these experts. You know, they're supposed to lead. And that's kind of an unpopular idea now. I think we have this kind of neo-populist and neo-progressive and anti-politician thing going on right now. I think that's misguided. In particular, I think it's really problematic when presidents explain what they're doing by saying, "I'm just doing what I was elected to do." You know, I don't want them to pass the buck back to the electorate. The buck stops here. I want them to exercise a little bit of independent judgment and stand by that.
Yeah, I think that this case that you've built in the book and it sounds like in a couple of other places is really interesting. I really enjoyed the book. I was curious, given some of the different things that you've mentioned along our conversation, what's next for you? Is there another book project that we can look forward to? What's on your summer agenda? What's on your fall agenda? What can we expect?
Yeah, absolutely. So the things that I have and I've kind of jumped into, one comes directly out of this project, and that's actually on party nationalization and asymmetry. So I've been doing a lot of archival work on the development of the two political parties and how the two parties have become increasingly nationalized. Going back to Andrew Jackson, this is conversation sounding like a very unhealthy obsession with Andrew Jackson, which might be true. That's a very decentralized party system that was originally designed. You know, our parties used to be very localized, and obviously now they're not, although in some ways they still are. So I'm looking at how the parties developed, and that kind of comes out of this project because I kept observing all these interesting asymmetries in the way that the parties developed their, you know, the way presidents of different parties developed their messages. And you were talking about the Use Your Mandate group, which was actually an anti-Chuck Hagel group, which I thought was kind of fascinating. Mm-hmm. So these dynamics of party politics that came out in this book, I'm kind of turning my attention full time to that. And also working on some vice presidential selection stuff, which is also kind of looking at how presidents lead their parties, or presidential candidates lead their parties, and the impact of different VP selections on the party long term. People tend to look at the VP selection and kind of say, well, did the candidate win the state the VP was from? And then that's the end of the conversation about the impact of the VP candidate, or did the VP candidate say something stupid? And I kind of want to look at what are the broader trajectories, and really look at in the ideas of one of my graduate mentors, Stephen Skowronek, how presidents change politics and change parties and the results of their actions.
It's really interesting, and look forward to all these new directions for your research. We have until these come out in their own forms, your current book, Delivering the People's Message, The Changing Politics of the Presidential Mandate, published this year by Cornell University Press. Julia, thank you very much for being on the podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.